Good afternoon, everyone. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio, where we can be found every day at blogtalkradio.com, 7 days a week, 7 different shows, multiple hosts, i.e. more than 7. Begins every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern. The Vito Esposito Show with Big Al, Mommy and No Sharia. That goes at 6 p.m. Eastern, as I said. And then Tuesdays, Eric is in with Cross and Crescent Discussion. That baby goes off at 6 o'clock Eastern as well. I'm in, of course, every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern time. And then Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern, Paul Sutliff with the Sutliffian Report. Fridays, usually around noon, Andrew Herod with Conservative Casual Friday. And then Saturdays, p.m. to midnight, Minister Usama Dakduk and the beautiful Christie revealing the truth about Islam. Sundays, Eric is back with the Real Interfaith Dialogue, which is a continuation of his Cross and Crescent discussion. That goes 3 p.m. Sundays, Eastern time. Now, for that one, you do have to get the app. You can't just go in and play. Some people have been doing it recently and trying to make trouble. Jack wagons, of course, but that's why on that one especially you have to do that. Hanging out here in Central Florida, Electric Hank Land, with my little mini Aussie. Mrs. Hank is working over in Acoustic Hank Land, and she's working hard, kicking you know what and taking names. So let's to our obituaries. Last Wednesday, we lost chemist Ralph Pearson at age 103. Now, Ralph Pearson proposed the qualitative theory of HSAB, also known as hard and soft acids and bases. That was in 1963. It was an attempt to unify the theories of reactivity in organic and inorganic chemistry. We also lost a couple of former basketballers. First, Illinois State Redbird center Cyrus Mann. He was drafted by the Celtics in the fourth round of the 1975 draft. And after 4 years playing in the Philippines, made a somewhat noted comeback in the Continental Basketball Association. He passed away of COVID at age 66. We also lost Luce Jackson, a former 76er out of Texas Southern and Texas Rio Grande Valley. He won gold with the U.S. men's team at the 1963 World Championships in Sao Paulo, and then won gold with the Olympic gold with the U.S. team in 1964 in Tokyo at those Olympics. He was an NBA All-Star in 1965. He won an NBA title along with 76ers teammate Will Chamberlain in the 1966-67 season. He almost defected to the Carolina Cougars. Remember them, the former ABA? And then he decided to stay in Philly. His career ended after the 1971-72 season, foot injuries. He passed from heart failure at 80. Thursday, wow, this was kind of a shocker. We lost former NL Cy Young winner and Major League Baseball Hall of Famer and split-finger fastball pioneer Bruce Sutter to cancer at age 69. I actually went to high school with his cousin, believe it or not. His name was Chris, and Chris passed a couple years ago as well. Anyway, Bruce Sutter pitched 12 seasons, all in the National League. First, he made his MLB debut with the Cubs in 1976, pitched there for 5 seasons, won the 1971 National League Cy Young. He then pitched 4 seasons with the Cardinals, won a World Series in 1982, finished his career pitching 3 seasons with the Braves. He was the National League Rolaids relief man winner 4 times. He led the National League in saves 5 times, and he was named to the NL All-Star team 6 times. He was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2006. And we also lost former Alaskan Republican politician Ben Stevens to unknown causes at age 63, apparently to an emergency in the Chugach National Forest, where Stevens was suffering some sort of medical emergency. Attempts to save him were unsuccessful. Hawkeye Mike just sent me a text, but he doesn't realize I'm already getting to it, but I go chronologically on these. Anyway, Stevens was the son of former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, who was President Pro Tem of the U.S. Senate from 2003 to 2007. Remember, Ted Stevens was falsely convicted of corruption charges, which led to his Senate reelection loss to Mark Begich, who was the son of former Alaska Congressman Nick Begich, by the way, whose family, including Widow Peggy, are the poster children for corruption and organized crime connections in the state of Alaska. In a bit of irony, both Nick Begich and Ted Stevens died in plane crashes in Alaska, Stevens in 2010 and Nick Begich in 1972. He was part of that mysterious disappearance, which was presumed a crash, with Louisiana Congressman Hale Boggs. He was the father of late journalist Cokie Roberts. The Boggs-Begich disappearance has been chronicled by journalist and podcaster John Walczak, part of his Missing in Alaska and Missing on 9/11 podcast series. You ought to give him a listen. They're actually pretty good. He surmises that there were some connections, with, believe it or not, with the Bonanno family. We also lost former musician and actor Mike Shank to cancer at age 53. Shank's best known for his appearance in the 1999 documentary American Movie, which was about the making of the short horror flick Coven. He also did a voice gig for TV's The Family Guy. Then we also lost former NBA Raleigh Celts at age 98. Now, he played in the inaugural season of the NBA with the Waterloo Hawks. It's the only major league pro-level sports team in Iowa history. And then finally on Thursday, we lost an American hero, former U.S. Air Force test pilot and NASA astronaut Jim McDivitt. He died in his sleep at age 93. Jim McDivitt flew 145 combat missions in the Korean War. He later became a test pilot, earned astronaut wings, believe it or not, on the X-15, and then he got on with NASA. He commanded the Gemini 4 mission. He later commanded the Gemini 4 was featured Ed White making the first U.S. spacewalk. Correctamundo. Ed White had a rather tragic end, of course. Jim McDivitt later commanded Apollo 9, the second manned Apollo mission, and the first that contained the lunar module, which later became the first to land on the moon with Apollo 11. During that mission, Jim McDivitt and his fellow crew member, Rusty Schweikert, entered the lunar module to test the lunar flight suits. Thus, they became the first astronauts to move from one spacecraft to another, as well as undocking and flying, test flying the lunar module. Thus, Jim McDivitt was instrumental in showing the viability of the lunar module for spaceflight and landing. This is going to sound stupid. He really was an American hero, but his biggest contribution to American pop culture was an appearance on an episode of The Brady Bunch. He played himself in the episode, long story, but anyway, he talked about a UFO experience. He later signed autographs for Peter and Bobby, knowing those guys, they probably pawned those things, sold them on eBay or something. Jim McDivitt was a true American hero. You know, he was the first to fly. He wasn't the first to spacewalk. He wasn't the first to land on the moon, but he did. He took part in missions that really set the tone and proved the viability of our spacecraft and our space equipment. And remember, don't forget, Apollo 9, yes, it was a couple missions later, but it wasn't that long after, just 2 years after the accident that, you know, of Apollo 1 that took the lives of Gus Grissom and Ed White, who I mentioned earlier, and Roger Chaffee. A true American hero. And I keep talking about this. Artemis is going to go up. They're looking down probably in November or December, and it's probably going to be shortened to like 35 days. And they'll end up paddling at the coast. The bioluminescence is out season. It is, we're still waiting for it to go off, let's put it that way. I'm not seeing it every day on the pad, but I'm waiting for it to go off, and I'm eagerly awaiting it at this point. I'm going to figure out a way to get out to Horseshoe Crab Island and park my ass out there for a few hours. Friday, we lost former American stuntman and actor Ted White at age 96. He worked on some cult classics, Escape from New York and Roadhouse. Then he had an on-screen role in Friday the 13th, the final chapter. Mike was asking if there's a window on Artemis yet. I did see it the other day, Mike. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it is November. Anyway, Ted White was in had an on-screen role in the Friday the 13th, the final chapter. Of course, we now know it was not the final chapter, not even close. Then, this is interesting, we lost former British porno actress Kate Parker at age 78. She made her mark in the Taboo series of films as sort of the prototype of the so-called MILF characters. She actually later appeared in several mainstream films and TV series, including 1982, the movie Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. Yeah, I know, quite a stretch for her, probably. Actually, probably not much of a reach. She later became a metaphysical counselor, which is obviously the next career step for porno actresses. Just like all strippers are actually working their way through law school, well, all porn actresses are working toward their career as metaphysical counselors. Anyway, she was 78. Also on Friday, we lost beloved, and I mean beloved actor, Robbie Coltrane at age 72. Robbie Coltrane's best known for his role as Hagrid in the Harry Potter films, but he was quite accomplished prior to that. He won numerous awards in British film and TV. He got films, his film start, from an American perspective, really, in 1986 film Mona Lisa. That actually got an Oscar nomination for Bob Hoskins, the late Bob Hoskins. He also was in the Eric Idle film Nuns on the Run. He was in two James Bond films. Yes, he was. Goldeneye and The World Is Not Enough. And in that one, he played a Bond ally. He was in two of them. He played the ally of Valentin Dmitrievich Shkovsky. He had a limited but crucial role as the editor boss of Robin Wright's character in the movie Message in a Bottle featuring Kevin Costner. No, it's not about the song by the Police. Anyway, but Robbie Coltrane evidently suffered from severe osteoarthritis in his last several years and very sadly gone at 72. Sunday, he lost a former attorney, Deputy AG and Attorney General Benjamin Civiletti to complications of Parkinson's at age 81. He was the first Italian-American to head the U.S. Department of Justice, served under President Jimmy Carter, which thusly almost but not quite negates his accomplishments. Yesterday, we lost musician and sometime actor Robert Gordon to acute myeloid leukemia at age 75. He's credited alongside with others with the revival of the rockabilly style, which, believe it or not, that revival was inspired in part by 1970 pseudo-punk rockers, Elvis Costello and Brian Setzer and a few others, Marshall Crenshaw, a couple others like that. Enough of our obituaries. Enough of death for today. Hey, don't forget, my friends, at Alliance Communications, Central Florida's 24-hour call center and answering service. Manage services for your clinic, medical office, advertising campaign, service industry businesses, hospitals, governments. They get the job done. They're very good at what they do. They work with remote staff as well as on-site staff. So if you like remote work, you might give them a call as well. Give them a call, 800-555-3738, or go on the web, alliancecommunications.com. Today's first Internet Laffy is from the Babylon Bee, and it says, Texas votes to airlift Austin to California. Oh, man, that ain't a lie. Austin is nothing like the rest of Texas. Oh, it's like Houston. I guess. No, it's not even like Houston. Because Houston is, I don't know, a rich version of Detroit, you might say. Austin is just like Seattle, I guess you'd say. It's a hot version of Seattle. Quickie, data from the University of Florida U.S. Elections Project shows over 2.7 million people have voted in those states that allow early voting for the midterm elections thus far, which is on pace with a record turnout of 2018. The disheartening part, more than 2.3 million have been by mail, only 337,000 in person. I say disheartening. Mail-in ballots lead to rampant fraud and corruption and integrity questions. Sorry for you lazy folks out there. It just does. By the way, there is no report on how many boxes Stacey Abrams has dropped off in Georgia. Mike just sent me back. Colorado's all mail. Gosh, is that a lazy state or what? Hey, I guess with weed being legal, it would be, wouldn't it? Okay, let's start with a poly sports story. This is from London's The Daily Mail. Seems that Nike co-founder and Oregon's richest person, Phil Knight, is throwing around cash in order to, quote, end Democrats' 40-year hold on the state and prevent the Democrat gubernatorial candidate, Tina Kotek, or Kotek, from winning the race. He's already spent millions, first to bolster independent candidate Betsy Johnson, and now to Republican nominee Christine Drazan. He says he's tired of the woke drug laws in the states. In the state, he was particularly upset with a New York Times editorial cartoon, which depicted a person snorting cocaine from like a big mountain of white, with the caption, which of these is illegal in California? And the answer was the plastic straw. Latest poll shows Drazan with about a 5-point lead. And if elected, she would be the first Republican elected governor or in Oregon since 1982, back when Diet Coke was invented and Men at Work was at the top of the pop charts. Yeah. Dopey Joe showed up to campaign for Kotek. His remarks included the following. Referring to Tina, P. Joe said, no lie, she has the lion of a heart. Okay, yeah, thanks for the visual, Dopey. Then, of course, he said, as long as Trump controls the Republican Party, he's going to have incredible impact on state legislative bodies. Obsessed much, Barack? Yes, that's what I said. Dopey Joe also announced he passed legislation to fight inflation that is driving down drug costs for the elderly. He said this while new brutal numbers came out for inflation and along with another upswing in gas prices. In a mild surprise, voters are actually turning away from the Democrat Party in Oregon, blaming them for soft policies on hard drugs and presiding over record crime waves. Gee, who'd have thought? Even Oregonians don't do enough drugs to shrug off that garbage. This from Yahoo. The mother of George Floyd's daughter has announced a lawsuit against Kanye West in the amount of $250 million. The reason? Well, because West, now known as Ye, made remarks that Floyd was no hero and didn't die so much from police action as he did from fentanyl. Baby Mama's attorney says in a statement, Kanye's comments are a repugnant attempt to discount George Floyd's life and profit from his inhumane death. Now, the slime ball attorney also noted that the suit is to, quote, hold Mr. West accountable for his flagrant remarks. They say it's all about the daughter, of course, and that she's having to relive George Floyd's death through Kanye West's remark. Yeah, evidently memorializing the death across big media, holding annual vigils, and continually citing it as the main reason for the need to defund the police isn't reliving it. Order sent to Yeh claims that his comments are causing damage to Floyd's estate and his family. Now, first of all, what estate, air quote, what estate are we talking about? If I recall correctly, George Floyd was passing fake 20s at a convenience store. And secondly, exactly what family, also in air quotes, exactly what family is being damaged and how? I'm telling you, I can't even believe I covered that story in a sense, but I couldn't resist at the same time. I mean, holy crap. I mean, what is going on? A couple of former NBA players are facing or have been dealing with health crises. First, former three-time slam dunk champ, all 5 foot 9 inches, Nate Robinson announced he's been battling kidney failure for the past 4 years. By the way, that means he was dealing with this when he fought YouTube boxer Jake 20. Yeah, I'd say that's pretty tough. He played a season of college football at Washington before he decided to concentrate on basketball. Played with 8 different NBA teams over his 11 seasons. Then in addition to that, former center Dikembe Mutombo has begun treatment for a brain tumor. He's born in the Congo, played college ball at Georgetown, then played for 6 different NBA teams over 18 seasons. At the time of his retirement, he was the second leading career shot blocker, a 4-time NBA Defensive Player of the Year, and an 8-time NBA All-Star. He has been noted for his humanitarian work in his native country, which included the creation and funding of a hospital in the capital city of Kinshasa. Probably best known for the visual of him lying on the court. Remember, he was holding a game ball to his chest and chanting, oh, my God, repeatedly. Remember, that was after the 8-seed Nuggets. They were down 0-2 in a 5-game series. They came back from an 0-2 deficit to win their first-round series over the Western Conference's top seed at the time, Seattle Supersonics. They were the first 8-seed to defeat a top seed, by the way, in the NBA playoffs. So, yeah, fervent prayers for both those guys. They are both top-notch guys, not just great athletes, but great citizens, as evidenced by the work that they've done humanitarian-wise and for charity, their public work. They're not just athletes. These guys are great citizens, and they need our prayers. Hey, guess what? Dopey Joe has announced new steps to lower gas prices and increase domestic production. This includes, of course, releasing another 15 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. You know, the step that hasn't worked any of the other times, except that Europe ends up getting a lot of our oil. I'm not sure how you're going to increase production when, one, you have previously put a stop to it on several levels, including terminating leases, terminating pipeline projects. Two, you have stated several times that the fault of high gas prices lies at the feet of Vladimir Putin. And three, you contradict all this by repeatedly begging on your knees to OPEC for increased production and output. Oh, and you also committed a possibly impeachable offense by asking to hold off doing anything negative until after the midterm elections. And yes, according to several legal experts, that may just be an impeachable offense. I will say this, gas has dropped to $2.99 a gallon at one of the Sam's Clubs in the area where we filled up Mrs. Hank's Jeep Cherokee the other day. Then again, that's still over 50% higher than it was when Dopey Joe was manipulated into office. This continues to go nowhere, naturally. Gas prices will not come down until the U.S. is back to energy independence, and more importantly, petroleum companies can safely invest in production without constant fear of having the damn rug yanked out from under them. On the heels of this, Dopey Joe's approval rating, which, yes, we have probably overestimated by about 10 points, is at its lowest point again after having had a big rebound in recent months. Although the GOP allegedly lost ground in electoral polls, they have gained a resurgence in the last few weeks. Oh, and the kicker and all this. Dopey Joe says he has a plan to refill the SPR when gas prices drop. Excuse me. When's that going to happen, Dopey Joe? Seriously, when is that going to happen? You released a ton of strategic petroleum reserve when gas prices were in the high fours and low fives per gallon. Prices have come down from that point. So why release strategic petroleum reserves versus refilling it? As usual, nothing from La Dopey Nostra makes any sense at all. Yikes. In a show of absolute corruption and a total joke, Igor Danchenko, he was a key figure in the anti-Trump dossier. He was acquitted on four counts of lying to the government after 10 hours of deliberation. The judge, a former George W. Bush appointee, had tossed a fifth charge in the case, as one of the allegations against Danchenko took place via email and not in person or via telephone. Technically wasn't lying when he said he never spoke to the person, per the judge. It really makes you wonder, what are Durham and his investigative team actually doing in preparation for these cases? I mean, Danchenko even admitted to some of what took place. I mean, then, of course, Durham and his team pulled the ultimate bonehead move of all time. What was that all-time bonehead move? Getting the testimony of FBI agents. I mean, seriously, an FBI agent putting his hand on a Bible in a court of law in and of itself is practically perjury. Unbelievable. Here's a story from the Epoch Times. I'm not saying it, nothing against the Epoch Times, but I love that. But it should have us all wondering just what the hell is happening at our college labs and medical schools and research facilities. You're not going to believe this, or if you do, you're rare in that, because I certainly can't believe this. The university defends controversial study on COVID hybrid strain with 80% mortality rate in mice. Issued a statement yesterday defending its research of a COVID-19 Omicron strain. They took the variant spike protein and attached it to the original COVID-19, leading to a higher mortality rate in a certain species of mice. The Omicron S-bearing virus robustly escapes vaccine-induced humoral immunity, mainly due to mutations in the receptor-binding motif. While Omicron causes mild, non-fatal infection, the Omicron S-carrying virus inflicts severe disease with a mortality rate of 80%, the preprint study said. Senator Roger Marshall, Republican from Kansas, said that the research entails lethal gain-of-function virus research that creates the potential to kill more people than any singular nuclear weapon. Marshall is a doctor, added that viruses have managed to escape even the most secure labs, and said such research must stop immediately while risks and benefits can still be investigated. Meanwhile, Emily Erbelding, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Division of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases, Boston University grant application didn't specify that researchers wanted to perform this work, and the group did not say it was performing experiments to possibly enhance a COVID-19 variant. She said the investigation is now underway, noting that the original Wuhan strain had a 100% kill rate in mice. Boston University issued a lengthy statement defending its research and said critics have misinterpreted the goals of the study while refuting allegations that the study involved gain-of-function research, which can make a pathogen more deadly or transmissible. So they updated it, responding to Emily Obelding's comment by saying the college fulfilled all regulatory obligations and protocols and that there was no gain of function with this research. I can tell you this, folks, we're having some foundation work. When people use funds like this, now that granted this is something different, this is not charitable per se, but it is nonprofit, would be my guess. Misuse of funds, lying about the use of funds, that can actually get your nonprofit status revoked. And you're lucky enough if you don't have to repay funds, but you can actually have your nonprofit status revoked. I just don't even know where to go with this. I mean, there are concerns that the manipulated strain could escape the laboratory. Guess what? They are legit concerns. As one doctor interviewed by the Daily Mail said, the issue becomes, what are you going to be using the labs for? If they're for diagnostic purposes, you need them. As he says, I don't think every country needs a BSL-4. That's some kind of, I don't know, I'm trying to find it. It boils down to this, though. It boils down to manipulating a dangerous virus. I don't know. I mean, I don't know where we're going in this country with this kind of stuff. Remember when I reported late 2019, early 2020 about Harvard scientist Charles Lieber and others who were arrested for not disclosing ties and remuneration from Red China? It's literally that same thing happening. It's like they didn't even learn from what's happened. Didn't even want to learn. It's disgusting. Welcome Vito to the chat room. He's in laughter. Indiehawk's been here the whole time. And then on the phones, we have Mike and Sue. If you want to get in, come into the chat room. You just come in online. Go to the live button. Click on that, then go to the right, down to the right-hand corner, look for chatters, and you'll see Global Patriot Radio. That's us. Or you can just dial the number, 319-527-6706. You can listen in that way. Believe it or not, you can also talk that way. If you come in that way, you hit the one, I get a little notification, a little raised hand that says, hey, somebody wants to talk. So do it. Try it. Anyway, here's another story from the Epic Times. This one should have us petting down to our local school boards with darn hands. This one. Mom ambushes school board by wearing drag queen costume to give them a taste of their own medicine. The Iowa mother, who donned a drag queen outfit and verbally ripped into members of the Ankeny Community School District, said the stunt was designed to spark awareness about inappropriate sexualized content in schools. The protest came after a drag show that happened at Ankeny High School in May. Footage of the costumed ambush blew up online, as the mom had hoped. Wow. On October 3rd, Kimberly Reichs, age 40, founder of the parent rights group Iowa Mama Bears, demanded answers regarding the outcome of a school board-led investigation involving the drag show hosted by the Gay Straight Alliance Club, which took place after hours in the school auditorium. She had two other parents that complained to the board right after the show. The board responded. The board actually responded that the performance was authorized by the administration, building administration, did not know follow the correct protocols, and was currently under investigation. They did not follow up, according to Rikes, and that's why she dressed the way she did right in front of the school board 130 days later. According to Rikes, certain authorization must have been obtained for the dancers and attendees to gain access to the auditorium, the lighting equipment, and the sound system. She added that two teachers were in attendance, along with several students, including one 12-year-old. She says, I, as a parent, could not even go into a school and eat lunch with my child without a full background check. But some guy could just walk in the back door without any background checks, and because he's part of the LGBTQ community, he somehow is not held to the same standard as I am as a parent with a child. She explained that her demonstration was tailored to evoke an emotional response from the school board members, adding that equipment failures were a fixture of previous board meetings where parents wanted to speak. The footage titled A Taste of Their Own Medicine, Ankeny School Board Meeting, was posted on Rumble. She said, I wanted them to feel a certain way because I found the tendency to be like, people go on emotion rather than fact. And that definitely is the reaction I got, and that's what I wanted. I wanted them to feel like, that's wrong, that's disgusting. Why is she in here like that? Because if they felt like that as adults, just imagine what a minor child felt like watching that man, dressed like that, performing the way he did in front of our children. Showing up in her regular clothes, Rikes is heard admonishing the board for lacking transparency and calling for an apology and assurance that it won't happen again. Disrobing, she then revealed the costume underneath, similar to one by a male performer in the show. She further castigated, does this outfit make you turn your head? Does this outfit seem appropriate for anybody here to see? This is what the man dressed like in front of our kids. So if this makes your head spin, if this pisses you off in any way, shape, or form, it should in the outfit that I am in today. But I have a point to prove, that this outfit should not be ever accepted in our schools anywhere. She added, I will do whatever measures I have to make sure events like this are addressed and resolved, even if that means wearing the same outfit as the 21-year-old drag queen performer, to prove my point. She received a swell of media requests and accusations, said she's been swamped from Charlie Ward to Newsmax to Fox. She was just on with Michael Knowles. She's a mom of four. She homeschools her three youngest children, now encourages concerned parents to dial up the heat, vocalizing their grievances against haughty school boards. She says, we have to be on top of it. And I always say to parents, you need to go to so many school board meetings, go to PTA meetings, go to whatever you can, do so much of it that they think you're on the payroll. Parents have gotten increasingly organized in resisting policies promoting transgenderism, inappropriate sexual content, and critical race theory classrooms across the country. In July, a group of 11 parents served a lawsuit in Virginia, Loudoun County, for its policy stifling parents from knowing if their children express different genders at school. Yep. Parents' protests were galvanized in May of 2021 when a female student was raped by a 15-year-old male in a girl's bathroom at Loudoun County's Stonebridge High School, and later again when state prosecutor Bhuta Biberaj tried to have the girl's father jailed for speaking out at a school board meeting. See what I mean by pitchforks? Yeah, we ought to be down there loud at these places. From what America or from American Action News, Senator Chuck Grassley had some statements on the FBI either not following up on or flat out withholding evidence revealing several criminal dealings by the Bidens. He says the FBI is hiding significant, impactful, and voluminous evidence of Biden family crimes. I always liked Chuck Grassley. He was a good senator when I lived in Iowa. So He says they've been holding, withholding evidence. We know that. And here's what he reports. He attached a contract signed by Hunter and James Biden and three other business associates. The contract was part of an arrangement designed to funnel $5 million from Red China, government-connected CEFC, to Hunter and James Biden to compensate them for work done while Dopey Joe was vice president, according to an FBI interview summary of Tony Bobulinski. But other records held by the FBI reveal frustration by the Bidens about the payment being delayed. Records previously released by Grassley and Senator Ron Johnson show James and Hunter Biden ultimately profited from a $5 million payment from a company connected to CEFC via a separate arrangement. Other records held by the FBI shed light on Hunter Biden's business and financial relationship with Burisma owner Mykola Lyshevsky. These documents include specific details about conversations by non-government individuals relevant to potential criminal conduct by Hunter. Also indicate that Joe Biden was aware of Hunter Biden's business arrangements and may have been involved in some of them. It remains unclear whether the FBI took appropriate steps to follow up on this information or passed it to the Delaware U.S. Attorney's Office. Grassley said numerous FBI whistleblowers have come forward with testimony and evidence of allegations bureau leaders interfered in the 2020 presidential election and aided Biden's election by blocking investigations of and falsely discrediting corroborated allegations of criminal activity by Biden family members. I mean, you know, this is not a shock, obviously. It is disappointing. I mean, literally, you literally used to be able to think. I mean, in the book The Godfather, not the movie, but in the book The Godfather, they talk about, if you remember the movie, Solozzo comes to Vito Corleone, not Vito Esposito, Vito Corleone, and asks for an investment and political protection to get into the drug business. And in the book, Solozzo talks about, you know, look, we can work with judges and cops, but of course, as we know, with importation, the FBI is incorruptible. That book was written in 1972. Or I'm sorry, that movie came out in 1972. The book was written in 69. But basically 50 years ago, less time than I've been alive. But 50 years ago, basically, we considered the FBI incorruptible. Now, it may be the most corrupt agency in all of our government. I mean, they're starting to make the EPA, the Department of Labor, and the Department of Transportation, they're starting to make those folks look pretty stand up. That's frightening. That's frightening. Because it's not, you know, this is also guys that you think of as, they're not CIA types, but from a domestic standpoint, you think that the average FBI agent is pretty much a badass, but, you know, kind of, in a way, a badass in a suit. Now, I mean, we don't even trust these people. Meanwhile, in NASCAR, I know, NASCAR. I hate even mentioning NASCAR. Anyway, black driver Bubba Wallace went off the rails in a race last weekend, apparently both while driving aggressively against Kyle Larson as well as physically assaulting him on the infield. His apology, not so stellar. He was actually called out on it on social media. This is from the Daily Wire. Basically, he released an apology Monday night for the incident that unfolded over the weekend, but he quickly caught heat for not apologizing to the one person that he violently attacked. Incident happened during stage two of some race around some track in Las Vegas. Wallace won stage one. He was next to driver Carl Larson when Kyle Larson attempted a three-wide pass. He moved up the track, and his car gave a slight tap to Wallace's car, causing Wallace's car to brush up against the wall. After brushing up against the wall, Wallace bounced into Larson's car and then continued by following Larson's car down the track and slamming into the rear of his car, causing both cars to spin out. In other words, that's aggravated vehicular attempted homicide. In a statement Monday night, Wallace claimed that he intends to, quote, to learn from this. And he seemingly apologized to everyone. He said, I want to apologize for my actions on Sunday following the on-track incident with Kyle Larson in the number 5 car. My behavior does not align with the core values that are shared by 23XI Racing and our partners who have played a crucial role in my incredible journey to the top of this great sport. I want to apologize to NASCAR and the fans along with Christopher Bell, Joe Gibbs Racing, and Toyota for putting them in a situation in the playoffs that they do not deserve. I compete with immense passion, and with passion at times comes a frustration. Upon reflecting, I should have represented our partners and core team values better than I did by letting my frustrations follow me outside of the car. You live and learn, and I intend to learn from this. He initially claimed that his steering was gone and that Larson just so happened to be there. He faced backlash over the statement, including being accused of trying to kill Larson by slamming his car into him at such high speed. Former MMA fighter Jake Shields tweeted, did you even apologize for when you faked a hate crime? Any race car driver knows what a garage door pull is. Another Twitter account said, top of the sport, you're ranked 19th. Good point. Another said, you're a race hoaxing clown. Another said, you almost killed another driver on the track. One former college football player tweeted, the woke media cares more about the Slipknot hoax he decided was a noose that the FBI actually investigated, than the murder that he tried to commit on the racetrack. Unsurprising. Yeah, you can see footage of him on the infield going after Kyle Larson. It's pretty disgusting, really. Hey, we are going to go to a break for a second, and then we'll be back with the crew. We'll talk some college football and a little bit of Hawkeye basketball. We have an internet laffy. It's not really a laffy, but it's an internet laffy, I guess you'd say. Fired and disgraced FBI agent Peter Strzok in the last couple of days claimed that 9/11 is nothing compared to January 6, 2021 in terms of trying to destroy democracy. Yeah, I know, it's not a laffy, but when you hear a guy say that, you kind of got to wonder, like, what in the hell? What in the hell? Okay, we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes. Enjoy a little bit of music while we take a break. Thank you. incomparable Vince Guaraldi with the Great Pumpkin Waltz. Bringing in Mike and Indy Hawk now as we speak. We are back. We are on Hank Jones Poly Sports. Call-in number is 319-527-6706. Come into the chat room by finding us under the live button looking for chatters. Mike, how you doing?
Doing good. How you doing, Hank?
Oh, not bad. My allergies are acting up the last couple of weeks. It really sucks. No. Indy, how you doing?
Too. I'm doing very well so far. Till Saturday.
That's good. Yeah, no kidding. Till Saturday is right. Hey, I missed your body shaming comment in the chat room. What was that in response to? Which
just when you used to be able to make fun of people or just looking like idiots, being idiots, but you can't do it now. So they're just
except
enabled.
To Lizzo. You can do it to Lizzo, I think. Did you hear, by the way, Lizzo says she doesn't make music for white people. I would argue that she doesn't make music at all, but that's just me. So anyway, Bama goes down into Tennessee on a game-ending walk-off field goal. Mike, your thought? Quick thought on that?
It was the highlight of the day last Saturday. I thought it was great. I just kind of get so tired of Alabama always being right there. I won't love it when they get knocked down.
What did they get knocked to in the rankings, do you know? I said they would
drop. Well, I don't recall, but I doubt they fell more than a couple spots. Maybe Indy Hawk knows.
Indy, what's your thought on this one? A close first half, and in the second half, Michigan absolutely crushes Penn State. Now, we all thought Michigan would probably win, but that Penn State had a chance. What was your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, I really liked Michigan. I'm kind of going back and forth. And, you know, a couple weeks ago, they didn't look good, but, you know, I really liked the quarterback. And, I was at the Iowa game last year, and I'm like, it's kind of a talent mismatch from what I was watching on the field. And then you put a really good quarterback, which, that kid is, and so far he's shown to be. They have a lot of potential, so it's going to be real interesting to see. And I'm just read an article today about the college football playoff. How does that play out with Michigan, Ohio State? Are they going to take three SEC teams? God help us, but –
I'm not sure how they can at this point, but who knows?
Okay, well, do they keep Alabama?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you've got Georgia, Tennessee, which will be a game because they're in the same division, so they're going to play, obviously.
Right.
Georgia still has to play Florida, I believe, in the world's largest cocktail. Or has that game already been played? It depends on the year. Sometimes it's played early, sometimes it's played late, but... But, I mean, you've got that.
I don't think they've played yet.
I don't think so either. But, I know Tennessee beat up on Florida. So, but Georgia-Tennessee's got to be coming up at some point. So that's going to be a big game. You just got to wonder how that's going to play out. I mean, one of those teams is going to have a loss, obviously. And if something happens to the other one, I can't believe they're going to take three SEC teams when at least one of them is probably going to have two losses.
Well, don't
forget Ole Miss, who's looking really good, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They're undefeated.
Clemson sitting there, too.
I was going to say that. Clemson hangs on against Florida State. And by the way, for a team ranked number four going in, they actually dropped a spot, by the way. But for a team ranked number four going in, Clemson is about the quietest undefeated team I can remember. I mean, nobody is talking about them, I mean, in years past, just one mediocre year out of them, and suddenly nobody knows who they are anymore, Any thoughts on that? Mike, your thoughts on that?
Obviously, I think Clemson's doing well, but the ACC is, a little bit suspect, I think. But I think that means that there's a good, very good chance that they get through the year undefeated. So how do you keep them out at that point?
Yeah, exactly. So USC goes down on a ballsy two-point conversion attempt by Utah. Anybody see any of that game?
I didn't see that game. I read a little bit about it afterwards. A little surprised. I thought Southern Cal was really on a roll, and Utah had already had a loss. but it just shows you there's some parity out there, and it'll be interesting to see. Now, I still think I still give USC the edge to come out of the Pac-12, but that really hurts their playoff chances, I think.
Yeah. TCU takes down Oklahoma State. Could be the top. They could be the top team of the Big 12. I mean, only undefeated team left. Syracuse is still undefeated, but they go to Clemson this weekend, so that probably ends that.
That will end.
I mean, I don't think they beat anybody other than Purdue.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned undefeated Ole Miss.
If you saw that game, by the way, Purdue kind of gave that game away.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Ole Miss goes to LSU this weekend, although that doesn't look like the tough assignment it has in past years. It's still LSU. You know, so it'll be interesting to see what happens. Lane Kiffin, you know, certainly he's proven himself to be a decent enough coach, so we'll see what happens. And then undefeated UCLA goes into Oregon this weekend. So it's either, you know, they come out of that.
Well, you know, Oregon, though, has been a little bit of a disappointment this year. UCLA is kind of a surprise. That's going to be a very interesting game. And, I kind of think UCLA is going to do it, but we'll see.
Yep. So, who's the midseason coach of the year in the Big Ten right now? Indy, who do you go with?
Boy, I don't know. I'm going to say it's not Kirk Ferentz.
No.
I tell you what, you know, Ohio State, to me, they look like the best team in America, but, you know, I think Harbaugh is doing a good job. You probably got to look at those two as far as where they're at. And I really hope we get – I'd love to see Michigan, Ohio State, Georgia, and whoever the other team out of the SEC would be if we get that. I'd love to see that. Now, Clemson has to bow out, but I would just like to see it. I think Ohio State and Michigan can match up, especially Ohio State. But.
Yeah. So, Mike, who would be your midseason coach of the year to be said right now?
You know, I hate to say it, but I kind of have to give it to Bielema.
That's what I was waiting for.
It's interesting. They did a better, much better. They look much better against Minnesota than they did against Iowa. Iowa really blew that game. If they'd had any kind of offense at all, they would have beat Illinois. But.
Yeah. I'm sorry,
Minnesota pretty solidly.
Is that Tommy talking or Hawkeye Mike?
Oh, that was Hawkeye Mike?
No, that's right. Tommy was just a year early, that's all. He was off.
He was a big Illinois guy.
He's picking Illinois every week last year.
Yeah, he was. Just a year
early. They're going to do it. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, they almost did a couple
but
times.
This year, they kind of made a believer out of me. I mean, that was a good win against Minnesota. They really were pretty their offense did nothing really in the Iowa game. It was a shame that Iowa didn't win. You held them to 3 field goals. How can you not win that game? I don't want to start going on an Iowa diatribe, but that game was so ripe for Iowa to win, just like the Iowa State game. Really, we should be 5-1, and we wouldn't have to have a very good offense, just kind of a subpar offense, and we'd be 5-1 right now.
Yeah. Well, the Illinois Purdue game is probably going to be for the West title. Think about that.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right.
That's ridiculous in a way. So, Mike, or Indy, I'll start with you on this one. This weekend will be for the Hawks. We're going to get to the Hawks. This weekend will be A, brutal, B, heart-wrenching, C, comedy, or D, the nail in the coffin for either or both Ferentzes. A, B, C, or D?
Is there an all of the above?
There is not.
It's going to be a really interesting game. 29 points is a ton of points. I mean, that's the spread. There might be 28 now. Might have moved. But that's just a ton. I mean, you talk about disrespect. I mean,
I looked this up.
This year, underdogs of 26 or points or more are 0-107 straight up. So the 0-107. That's hard to do.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of disrespect for Iowa. I mean, I think with Iowa's defense, there's a chance. You know, I mean, who knows? But it's going to be really interesting to watch. They got to show up and obviously suck it up and make their season right now, or you know, we're going down. But
I mean,
no,
basically,
I think that's right.
Here's
yeah.
basically the over under is 49. So odds makers basically are saying, calling the game basically 39-10 or worse. I mean, if we score 10 points, that'll be shocking. 10 points will be shocking in and of itself. So,
Well, you know what, though? I will say this. Ohio State is not the best defense that Iowa will have played this year. I think Illinois had the better defense, so and probably maybe Michigan. It's Ohio State's offense that's the juggernaut, but I think that you can move the ball on Ohio State if you have a decent offense, which we don't. So, but I do think we'll do something there. I think you know, in that those ABCD thing you gave me, I don't know which one quite fits, but I think that it's obviously we could just get blown away. I think there's a chance of that, but I think Iowa's defense. So if the over-under is 49, I'm going to go on the under there. And on the 29-point spread, I think Ohio State, I think, wins the game, but I think it might be something like 24-7, 28-7, something like that.
Yeah, I could see
that. I would agree with that. I think if we can turn it into a boring game,
because of our defense.
Why are we covering this nationally? We do really well in those games. There's no offense here. This is an ugly game. That's when we're in it, you know. It's defense.
Yep.
Nobody likes defense. You know, drag them down, slow them down. Man, if we can get a couple stops early, who knows? That starts to pop in their head about the last time they played us. So, who knows?
Yeah, but you know,
Here's what's impressive about Iowa. You know, we talk about how bad Iowa's offense. Here's what's impressive about Iowa's defense. Let's look at Illinois. The week before they play Iowa, they beat Wisconsin and Madison 34-10. Then it's a 9-6 game. They really, if you look at that game, their offense just, you know, particularly in the second half, they just didn't do anything. They got that field goal finally to win it, but I think they got started with good field position on that, if I'm not correct. But then the following week against Minnesota, it was like 31-10 or so. I can't remember exactly.
26-14,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay, even worse. So this is Illinois team that has against teams with that are supposed to be pretty tough on defense, racking up the points against Wisconsin on the road and then against Minnesota, and they could do squat against Iowa's defense.
Yeah.
And I think if you go back to the Michigan game too, Michigan got – it was really 20 points. They got a garbage time sort of touchdown when Iowa got desperate and had to go for it on fourth down from their own territory and turn the ball over. And by the way, that game, you know, I was at the 6-yard line on fourth and two. If they could have got in, maybe they don't win, but it would have been, you know, like a 20-14 game or something. And I really think 20 was all Michigan really got out of that game. So I think you got to give Iowa's defense some real credit here. That's why I think that we're looking at a 24-7, 28-7, 28-10 type game. And who knows?
If you want some hope, I found the draft talent rankings, Pro Football Focus. Iowa is number 10 as far as NFL talent on the field Saturday. Ohio State is third. But, you know, on paper, that's not a mismatch. So it shouldn't be like we get blown away.
Right, it's not a mismatch. Iowa's on the field can play with them, I think, yeah.
Exactly. Execute some offense, and you got a shot.
Okay, I'm going to go with brutal.
And maybe a little turnover or two might help early.
I'm going to go
like
with brutal.
3 seconds
I'm going to go with
game.
A brutal. Yeah, I'm going to go with a brutal for this reason. The times that Iowa, and not just Iowa, but teams like Purdue, the times that they have upset Ohio State in what I would call the Urban Meyer Ryan Day era. The times that Iowa State or Ohio State has been upset, it has usually not been in a low-scoring game. I mean, we absolutely decimated them. Purdue did the same thing a couple of years ago. Michigan scored a lot of points last year. I mean, it tends to not be a defensive struggle when Ohio State loses. It tends to be high scoring, but the team – and see, we just don't have the offense to do that. We don't have anything remotely close to what we had in 2017 offensively.
Yep, got to punch him in the face.
And you may not see this till possibly the Michigan game or maybe even in the playoffs, but I think the way Ohio State can be beat – the type of team is a team that can keep the ball offensively and just be slow, methodical, have a run game, maybe a Georgia or somebody like that, or maybe a Michigan. But that's how you're going to be, and then keep their offense off the field and you know, just kind of control the pace, I think. That's how you beat. Now, if Iowa had a little better offense, I think we'd be well equipped with our defense to do it. And it's a real shame about our offensive woes because – with a defense like this, like I keep saying, if we had any kind of offense, this could be a darn good team.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely could. I mean, I don't know. Okay, Mike, let's start it this way. What would be, I mean, knowing what we have right now, what would your game plan be Saturday? I mean,
I think the game plan would be, As I said, is if we could establish some sort of run game, and like Indy Hawk kind of alluded to, I mean we're not going to outscore. You made the point about how when I was upset, I'm like 2017, we just had a great offensive day, but I don't think that's not going to happen. But if Iowa could somehow just kind of control the ball offensively, and then establish a run, throw off the run that like traditionally Iowa does. That's our only hope. I don't see it very likely to happen, but I don't see any other way that we could hope to try to stand up to them. We're not gonna win a 42-35 shootout. I mean,
exactly. Indy, what's your game plan? Knowing what we know right now, what's your game plan?
I agree with what Mike's saying. If you could tell me, okay, we can have one play for 80 yards and a touchdown or a 14-play 80-yard drive chewing up 7-8 minutes, I'd take the latter because then they start to go, oh, my God, we haven't even run a play yet. And they start to press a little bit. And then, we've got a great defense. So I still believe in our defense. I think our offense is coming around. So who knows?
Yeah. I think of this, okay, I was looking at something today. Okay, there are 32 – former Iowa players on active NFL rosters, 9 on practice squads, 3 on injured reserve. I look at recent early entries. Now, defensive side of the ball, it hurts a little bit. Look what we've lost offensively in the last several weeks. I mean, both Hockenson and Fant in the same year. We were talking about guys from Iowa on our text who could be still eligible. But, I mean, people even say, Goodson was dancing around too much. I'll tell you what, I'd take a Tyler Goodson right now. As much as I like our running backs, I think Tyler Goodson still brings the home run guy that I'm not sure we have, except when we're playing teams like Nevada. A Tyler Goodson would make a difference. Hockenson and Fant, some of our linemen that we've lost the last few years. I mean,
I'd love to have Nate Stanley back.
Yeah. Oh, of course. I mean, almost any of our quarterbacks, but other than I get that they're not blaming Spencer Petras for everything that's happened, but you got to make a change, and I think that's the one place you can make it that can shake things up. I mean, I just don't see, what are you going to do? You're going to put in a different left tackle? Is that going to shake things up? Is that going to make the team really rally? No. But they might rally around a different – I mean, I'm just saying. So here's an interesting stat. Here's a really interesting stat. The last 14 games – the Iowa Hawkeyes are 7-7. During that time, Hawkeye quarterbacks have attempted 15 passes inside opponents' 10-yard line. We have completed 7 with one touchdown. And that was the one against Michigan at the end. Now, here's the real kicker. the total yardage on those seven completions. Anyone want to hazard a guess? Indy, what would you guess? The total yardage on those seven completions.
It's not going to be good.
Okay, no. Draw the number.
10 yards.
Mike, throw out a number.
Well, you know, you're talking seven completions made inside the 10. So,
doesn't
yeah,
matter.
So
throw out a number. Throw out a number.
You know, 12 yards.
Three. 3 yards.
Yeah, it's even worse than I thought. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's
that
that's
damn screenplay
less,
doesn't work.
That's less than a half yard per completion. That's bad enough. Now throw in the fact that we sometimes run a jet sweep inside the 10, you know, or that we, like Andy said, that screen pass, you know, I mean, it just, something is
but you're
is
not even
working.
You're not even 50% on those. You're not even 50%. Wow.
Yeah, that's the other thing. You're not even throwing for 50% inside the 10-yard line, which begs the question, why are they throwing inside the 10-yard line? But that's another, you know, that's another matter. I mean, brother Tommy's friend who played in Illinois and still watches the games said he couldn't believe the fact that we were inside the 5-yard line and threw passes, that we literally didn't just run the ball down their throat. I mean, I guess what I don't understand, if we're having problems on the offensive line, what would make us think that inside the 10-yard line, our pass blocking is suddenly going to improve enough? I mean, it's frightening. It is absolutely terrifying. So let's get to some picks for this week. We'll go with our Big Ten picks. So our first game, I'm not going to go with Big Noon kickoff. So let's go Indiana at Rutgers. Rutgers is 3-3. They're favored by 3. Indiana is 3-4. Over and under is 48. Mike, who's your pick?
This could be a very good game. I think Rutgers might win at home. I'm
okay,
going to go with Rutgers.
Indy?
I'm going to go Rutgers at home.
Yeah. Okay, good pick. Okay, 3:30 game. Purdue at Wisconsin. Wisconsin is actually favored by 2.5. The over under is 51. Indy, who are you going to go with?
I'll tell you, I've got a guy I know pretty well, and he's a big Purdue. And I actually looked at their record and their games. They're an eyelash from being undefeated. I mean, Purdue, I think they're 2 3-point losses, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm gonna go Purdue. I think they're just think if they had won those games, and we all know those things come down to a play or two, and some years they happen, some years they don't. Purdue's a sleeper here.
Okay, Mike, how about you?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think Purdue's going to win. You know, Wisconsin seemed to bounce back, but Northwestern's really bad. And I don't think Wisconsin's going to match this up good with Purdue, particularly Purdue's offense. And I think Purdue's going to win, just like they went up to Minneapolis and won up there. I think Purdue's going to win by 14.
Wow. That's a shocker. Okay, so Northwestern at Maryland. Maryland by 13.5, over under 51. Let's just put it this way. Mike, you're up. How much do you – I guess it's not so much are you picking Maryland. It's does Northwestern have a chance?
The Northwestern's about the only team that I have confidence Iowa can beat in the remaining games, and maybe I shouldn't. They're really not very good, and Maryland's a decent team. Maryland's going to win. It'll be like 28-7, I think.
Yeah, Andy, how about you?
I'm going to go the same thing. I don't know what's happened to Northwestern football, but, you know, they seem like they're always pretty good, but I don't know.
They've actually lost some guys in the transfer portal. They're another one that's fallen victim to some of that stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Minnesota at Penn State. Penn State favored by only 4, over under 44.5. Andy, who are you going with?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I'm going to go Minnesota because I think it'll come down to a field goal. But okay, that's pretty a heck of a game.
Yeah, Mike, who you got?
Yeah, this is a tough call. It's going to be close. I think, you know, Minnesota's shown some flaws when their losses to Purdue and then to Illinois. But then Penn State looked pretty bad against Michigan. And I thought, I kind of gave Michigan the edge in the game, but I didn't think I thought Penn State would play a better game, and they really just got outclassed. And it's at Happy Valley, but this is a tough one. It's gonna, you know, neither team's playing too well right now. Have their confidence challenged. I'm gonna go with Penn State at home to win in a really close one.
Okay, here's the thing. Okay, Minnesota's two losses against Purdue, they did not have Mohamed Ibrahim. He didn't even play, and then against Illinois, Tanner Morgan got hurt. Now, you mentioned Iowa holding Illinois, but let's not forget in that game, Illinois was missing Tommy DeVito for most of the first, from the first half on. So, all that kind of plays in.
Yeah.
I'd have to go Penn State, though. I just think at home, we don't even know whether Tanner Morgan is really going to play yet. I haven't heard. I just think Penn State's just a better team overall, but I don't think Penn State's as good as we were thinking a couple of weeks ago either.
I agree with you on that.
It was a big win against Purdue, but since then they haven't really played anybody that really matters that much. So, okay, finally, Iowa at Ohio State, the big new kickoff on Fox, the 9% point OSU is the line with a 49 over under. So, Indy, we're going to start with you. Pick your winner, pick the spread, and pick over or under.
I will take Ohio State and Iowa on the spread, and then the under.
Okay, so you think Iowa covers?
Yeah, oh, it did, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah,
Mike,
I say
you?
Definitely. You know, depends
okay.
what team
yep,
you show.
Yep, I think Iowa covers. It's 29. I think they do. I think they are under on the over-under. And Ohio State wins, but I think it's going to be like 27-10, something like that.
Okay. Boy, I wish I could feel that enthusiasm. I'm just not – I mean, when I look at the two deeps and see that it's still Spencer Petras and – you know, not much else changes. There's no Keegan Johnson in the two deeps.
Where's Keegan Johnson?
Well, it is.
He is not going to play. He's not ready to play yet. That's the latest appearance.
They're basically saying right now that it's hamstring. At least they're not holding that back anymore. You know, for a while they were holding back what was wrong. Now they're just. And I think there's
a
reason
they ought to
start saying,
looking at a red shirt for this guy now, you know, if he's not going to play this week.
Well, I think the reason they're saying it is to quell any rumors that he's holding out because he wants to transfer. I think there's some people that are overblowing all that stuff. I mean, look, say what you will about Charlie Jones. Charlie Jones wasn't going to Purdue until they lost two receivers plus David Bell. He wasn't going to Purdue. That wasn't even on anybody's radar. I mean, people sit there and say, "Oh, he saw that what's going to happen," and all. You know, give it a rest. You know, it was a crappy move by him. It was a crappy move, I think, by Purdue. But be that as it may, it is what it is. But I think the part of the reason we're hearing that Keegan Johnson is not playing is, and that it's hamstring, is because I think they're trying to quash any of those types of rumors. You know, that he's always
quit. I heard a rumor that any wide receiver playing with Petras will be eligible for a red shirt, but I can't confirm.
The other thing is, I just don't think – I think our line just isn't good enough to – I mean, everybody's saying, Ohio State, it's their offense, but their defense is better. I just don't like the idea of this line.
I would remind you, Hank, that both Indy Hawk and I are picking Ohio State to win.
Yeah, but you're picking us covering, and you're picking the under. I've got visions of 1995, where Ohio State led 56-0 at half. And let's not forget the 1995 team for Iowa actually won eight games, including the bowl game, actually went 7-4. actually had a good, you know, had guys like Cedric Shaw, had good linemen. I think it could
easily go something like that. I'm not denying that. I'm just thinking that Iowa's defense is going to keep it semi-respectable. That's kind of the way I feel. But you know, I mean, if we have a
those young guys in the line, more they're now juniors. I mean, we're seven games in, so if you haven't figured it out, they should be. So they should be putting some things together.
Let's hope. Yep. I'm just not that confident. So
I think Iowa's going to play like they have nothing to lose, which they don't. And maybe Ohio State is a little bit flat. You know that now. So I don't have any, you know, real reason to believe that, but that's just a feeling maybe. And as I said, I think Ohio State's going to win, but it's going to be a little bit more like a 27-10 game or 28-10 game or something like that.
The only thing that might change that is the quote from Ryan Day this week that said that Iowa game in Kinnick was a scar that doesn't go away. And he says he's been reminding his team of that. And coaches. So.
Well, you know, they're trying to find a way to get their team up, and I understand that. None of the players on this Ohio State team have any experience against Iowa, and they weren't on that team. So it's not a personal experience for anybody that's going to be out on the field.
Well, I mean,
like a year after that, you know, it would be a bigger – and we were going into Columbus – and it was 2018, that would be a much different situation.
I agree.
True. So, okay. So I'm also of the opinion, I think unless something drastically changes, which I don't think will happen, I think if we stay, you know, with the status quo, I think Brian Ferentz is gone at the end of this year. Somehow gets looped into another job somewhere else, back in the NFL maybe. You know, his brother James is still playing in New England, so you know there's that possibility. Maybe I don't see him getting demoted. I don't see that happening. I could see a co-offensive coordinator, but unless something drastically changes, I think this has got to be it for him, and I think it will be. I really do.
Maybe,
the other thing I think
maybe a lucrative deal in the Arena Football League or something like that. Maybe.
Yeah, that could happen. You know, with the NIL collective.
My take on this is a little different. I'm not sure that the main problem here is Brian Ferentz. I really think it's Kirk Ferentz. And so if you get rid of Brian and bring someone else in, you're still going to have Kirk there kind of just as a big break on what any offensive coordinator wants to do. And they're playing the offense and the style and they're playing the quarterback. I regret to say this, that Kirk Ferentz wants to play.
Some of Brian's comments.
I just think the main problem, I have to say, I think the main problem here is the head coach.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that. Definitely not. I mean, I'm not.
He's 67 years old and he's a Hall of Fame coach. I mean, this is a hard thing to deal with. It really is.
And he's not going to go anywhere. I mean, I really think it's time for change. But I know the reality is that Kirk Ferentz is likely not going anywhere. And, you know, whether Brian goes or not, I mean, let's assume that you're right, Hank, that Brian's gone after this year, you know, finish 5-7 or something like that, or even 6-6, which I think is a likelihood. Whoever comes in as offensive coordinator, I just have no confidence that under the constraints of the Kirk Ferentz coaching philosophy, that we're going to see a whole lot of change from what we're seeing right now. We can hope that we get better quarterbacks. That's the thing that I don't. We have had better offenses because we've had better quarterbacks, and then Kirk has just stubbornly insisted that Petras is the guy and that he hasn't played one – no one else has played one down this year. And Padilla at least played a lot last year. I just don't get it. But that just – I mean, it just makes me shake my head. And It's like, what is going on with Kirk Ferentz? That's what I don't get.
Well, here's the other rumor that I see pop up. Supposedly, Padilla is just marking time and staying right now to make sure that we've got a viable backup in case something happens to Petras, but that he's graduating at the end of this year and he's going to med school and he's done with football. Now, I don't know. You know, again, you know, take that with you, you know, with a grain of salt. The other thing I'm seeing way too much of this, way too much of what this and that is. How many people are you seeing? I don't know how much you guys are going on to either Twitter or any of the other stuff. How many people are saying, you know what, I've been calling it for years that Kirk was the problem with the offense. You know, so we have a lot of people that are suddenly saying that they were clairvoyant and they said they knew this was going to happen all along. You know, I mean, I'm a little tired of that as well because, you know,
well,
in
2017, I never saw that really.
No.
You know, last year we saw some problems, right, on offense, big problems, but. It's just I thought we would be better this year naively, and I don't, I just have no explanation for our offensive philosophy and Kirk's unwillingness to try to, you know, do anything to try to make changes, including the quarterback this year. And I just don't know. I mean, if you go back in the Kirk Ferentz era, you know, we had these dual threat quarterbacks in the first 10 years. You know, Brad Banks, and then you had Drew Tate, and then even in as recently as with C.J. Beathard, I don't understand why, what is going on offensively and in terms of our whole philosophy. It just seems to be so stale and stagnant, and we didn't used to be that way. Is it? I mean, is it just that the games passed him by? That's a kind of a cliche. I just don't. I mean, what's really going on here? I don't quite understand it. I just don't think Brian Ferentz, you know, he's doing what is – he's running the offense his dad wants to run, I think.
Yeah.
And he – you know, I mean, I just don't – I don't really know what's going on, but I just feel like that this is on Kirk Ferentz more than anybody else.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. I mean, you know, I think there's some –
And I'm someone, people... I'm someone who's been a big Kirk Ferentz fan, you know – Forever.
Well, I go back.
Yeah, really,
Look at 2020, where we were the second best offense in the Big Ten, I think, or at least in the West Division. Maybe it was, but you know, we had a productive offense in 2020. Now people will say, well,
right.
Look at
so
the schedule.
Was the quarterback?
Yeah, look what the schedule was. But also look at the line. You had Linderbaum still, who you had him last year, but you also had Mark Kallenberger, and I forget there was a couple others that were on that line that are gone now. You know, I mean, I think that we just haven't replaced guys as well as we usually do. Maybe could be the thing. You know, I think Mark Kallenberger, had he been there last year.
I think Jackson came. Jackson was back for his last year in 2020 at the tackle.
Yeah,
too.
Exactly. Alaric Jackson was back. You know, a host of that stuff.
But yeah, you're right because we had with Emir Smith Marset was an absolute weapon. I've been thinking about that, too. When you look at the 2020 team, and obviously, you know, you got to factor a little bit in COVID, but that offense in the last six games when we won 6-0 after losing the first two, and it was really, you know, a pretty good running machine.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And Tyler Goodson had a good year. I thought by the end of the year, Petras was looking. I mean, I think maybe the offensive line was giving him time to throw.
Yeah.
And he had some real we had some real weapons with Smith Marset. Tyrone, you remember Tyrone Tracy had a great year in 2020.
And then in 2021,
he was disappointing.
Brandon Smith. Yeah,
Brandon Smith. Exactly. We had some real weapons and LaPorta had a good year. We had some real weapons, and our offense was pretty darn good. And then in 2021, it was like a disturbing downward trend, and it's continued and gotten worse this year. So, you know, I'm just trying to think, how come we were so much different? There was so much different offensively in 2020, just in 2 years ago, and with Petras as the starting quarterback that year.
And is it Doyle being gone? You know, people ask about that. I mean, all those things.
Well,
there are just so many questions. There are too many questions, I guess.
I know. And I just kind of scratch my head because I don't understand what's going on here.
Yep. Okay. So on to basketball.
George Barnett too.
On to basketball. Chris Murray is slated to be first-team All-Big Ten. Luka Garza signs a two-way contract while Wieskamp gets cut. And here's the first question. Any word from anyone heard anything on Joe Toussaint, what's happening with him at West Virginia?
I have not heard
anyone?
Anything.
I have not heard anything about him, no.
He's at West Virginia.
I guess we'll just
right?
have to wait. And... Right. No, I think that's right. We'll just have to wait and see, you know, when the season starts, whether how prominent he is on that team.
Yep. North Carolina nationally is at the hot top of the poll for the preseason. I'm pretty sure we're not in it, but I could be wrong on that. I didn't look as closely at that yet because it really doesn't.
We are not.
I'm sorry?
We are not.
Okay, I didn't think we were.
In fact, there's, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there are three Big Ten teams in the top 25. There's only one inside the top 20. I think that goes back to like 1980, doesn't it?
That might be, in a way, though, that might be good news for Iowa because it could mean, I mean, I think the implication
Absolutely.
You're making is that the Big Ten's a little bit down this year, which could help Iowa
yep.
because I think everybody thought this was going to be a rebuilding year, although I think Iowa's got some real talent. We'll have to see. I think Iowa's going to have to prove themselves on the court, and they're going to have some chances early with the schedule they have, so we'll see. But I'm not totally, I know Indy Hawk's a little more down on them. I have some optimism about this team.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I just don't know. It's so hard to tell.
But I think we've got a lot of talent there. And I think Chris Murray, I really do think Indy Hawk touched on this last time we talked about him. That Chris could have done even more last year if Fran had kind of given him a little more of a chance. I think he's going to be an absolute star. He'll be as important to this team as Keegan was to last year's team. I think that's going to be the case. And I'm not saying that they're the same. They're a little different in terms of how they play, but he will be as important to this team as Keegan was to last year's team. But I also think with Tony Perkins – and some of the other people we have coming back that we're, you know, I know there's some controversy about the McCaffreys. I think they can be a good influence on the team. I think Connor's a good quarterback. We'll see if Patrick can get a little better and be a little more consistent. But, and Peyton Sanford and some of these other guys coming in, I think we've got some talent there. So we'll see what happens. And if the Big Ten's a little down, then that gives us a little better chance to do something.
Well, I think we have four teams in the top 25, but only one in the top 20. So, interesting. Two coaches, what's his name, Drew at Baylor and the guy at Missouri, are both calling for the NCAA to be added, to be increased to 128 teams for the NCAA tournament. Is that even...
Well, you know, it's basically one more game, right, is all you're adding. So I think that's the argument. You know, to get everybody in the tournament, you just have to – you basically would have to go to 100 – to go to 128 teams, you would have one more game. You might have some more buys for the really good teams.
It seems like they've been talking about that for 20 years. You know, one more weekend and we can have everybody just come in.
Well, you can make an argument. It's not necessarily a bad thing for college basketball to have an extra week in March Madness.
It'd be crazy. It'd be cool.
Well, but here's the funny thing about that. We're also talking about, the fact that there's too many bowl games. We want to increase college football playoff, but there's too many bowl games. But yet they're wanting to go to, 128 teams in the – I mean, the second 64, let's face it, I don't know. I don't see the reason. And it doesn't make an even bracket. You're going to have like some first round stuff that doesn't,
Yeah, but you look at,
Iowa
loses to teams like that, though.
Actually, just to shift back, you're touching on the bowl games. But I mean, it might be a couple of years down the road, but it looks like it's going to go to 12 playoff teams. I'm just wondering, at that point, other than within the playoff system itself, what's the rationale for any bowls at that point? Why shouldn't it just be like the NFL or the FCS level, where you either make the playoffs or your season's over, when you're talking about a 12-team playoff? And so, I mean, I think the bowls are becoming less and less relevant. If you look at the lower bowl type bowls now, you know, the Independence Bowl type bowls, they can't fill up the stands. Even something like the Holiday Bowl, I think when I played there against Southern Cal in 2019, I don't think it was a full crowd. You just don't see it. You don't even see it in the Outback Bowl in Tampa.
Citrus Bowl last year. Citrus Bowl for the first New Year's Day this year. I mean,
and it's because they're becoming irrelevant. The playoffs have just kind of made them less relevant. And you go to a 12-team playoff, I just don't think there's much rationale at all for any bowl games at that point. You know, if you're not good enough to be in the top 12, you know, I just don't think any bowls are going to be very, you know, there's just not going to be a draw for them. And you know, maybe that's all right, though. You know, you can still have some of these major bowls be part of the, you know, like part of the playoff system. We'll see how they do that, but the Independence Bowls and the Holiday Bowls and all these kinds of bowls, I just think they just lose any, you know, basis for existing.
Yeah, but again, tell that to the city of Orlando, which has like three bowls, you know, that play here. You know, I mean, they.
No, I know.
They kind of like
it. It's not, you know, they're not going to like it, but I just think when you really get to a 12-team playoff. They're just going to be an irrelevance. I mean, I just really think.
I'm not arguing against that. I mean, I think that's pretty, you know, I think that's a pretty good point. So we start our exhibition season on 31st, on Halloween. I guess I forgot who. I even forgot I mentioned it before, but it's obviously somebody who doesn't even rate in the grand scheme of things. But, I mean, what are we looking for in a game like that, you know? I mean, what is it that we're looking to see, you know, to happen?
Trying to get people on the floor, get the young guys out there, Devontae Bowen and Josh Dex, see what they got, get them, you know, get a little PT, get them out there. Get an easy win. A couple of those are good. And we've got a pretty wicked non-conference schedule, like really wicked.
Yeah.
Seton Hall,
yes,
Duke,
we do.
Georgia Tech, Iowa State, Thanksgiving for me, Clemson.
Yeah.
TCU, California. I mean, this could get ugly early.
Yeah, I mean, it's Truman State. That's who we play. And then we open with Bethune-Cookman, North Carolina A&T, and then we go to Gavitt against Seton Hall. And then we've got the Emerald Coast Classic preliminary game against Omaha. And then we've got
we may get beat up a little bit and lose some of those games, but I actually think it's not, you know, early in the season's not such a big deal, even if you get beat up a little bit. I think playing some of these tough games preseason can really help us for the Big Ten. And what you want to do is finish strong.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not going to be the same team in at the end of February or the first week of March, especially this team, I think, that we were in the first couple weeks of November. Like Indy Hawk said, what we'll be looking forward is to get some, there's a lot of new faces and some, I'll be interested to see if Peyton Sanford really picks his game up. I think there's an anticipation from some of the stuff he did last year, especially towards the end of the year, that he could really contribute and be a good player for us. Well, let's see if that happens. I want to see if Tony Perkins continues to be strong and make improvements. Same thing with Tyler Ulis and Rebraca. And then we'll see just how good Chris Murray is.
I think we've got a chance. I mean, to me, Chris Murray is going to be unbelievable. I mean, Andrew Katz picked him to be a preseason All-American, or, you know, number one surprise pick. You talk about a layup. I mean, all you got to do is double his minutes, 17 minutes, 9.7 points, 4.3 rebounds. So you're talking 19 points, 8.5 rebounds, just by playing him full minutes. I mean, he should have been playing last year. Can you imagine that, the Murray twins? So he's got to be the go-to guy.
Yeah, and I couldn't understand
For the first time, we have a chance to have a good defense. We never play defense under Fran. You can't have slow people out there. But you take guys like Ulis and, you know, some of these guys that can, you know, got some athleticism. Perkins is phenomenal. Rabacek can move.
Yeah.
Murray's athletic. So I want to see some defense. So that, I think, will have that's where we have a chance.
Yeah, you know, it boils down to a couple things. Number one, who is our new point guard? There is no J-Bo anymore, so I assume it's Ulis, right?
I think so.
I think so early. But you know what? I kind of am glad that we – I have to be honest. I'm kind of glad we don't have J-Bo anymore. I think so wildly inconsistent, and you couldn't rely on him, especially in the last couple of years. And I think he hurt the team some.
Yeah.
Well, defensively, I mean, my gosh, you know, nothing against J-Bo, but you look at him athletically, he's going against big-time Division I point guards. Connor McCaffrey, same thing. We played him at the power forward for an entire year. You know, he can be a great kid, but he's not quick. You know, he's 6'5". He's not a great leaper. You know, where do you play the guy? Defensively is where you got to lock people. That's the one thing that the great teams always do. And if you look back at Iowa's defensive rankings through the years, they're just horrible. You know, we always have a top five offense and a bad defense, and we get dumped in the first round or two if we make it.
It'll be interesting to see our new guys, Bowen and Dix. Dix, I think that had the injury. And so he's supposedly healthy. Bowen is supposed to be very athletic. So, you know, it's just going to be interesting.
He's a legend in his own mind, anyway.
Who's that?
Oh, really?
DeSante Bowen.
How's that?
Made a remark. I read that he was the fans are really going to love the way he plays, or something like that.
I'd rather hear that.
Good to see a little confidence. I mean, you know, that's intriguing. You know, we'll see.
You know,
he lives up to his own hype.
Yeah, it's better than.
Let me ask you guys something here. Iowa was recruiting a guy named J.P. Estrella. He was a four-star big man. I mean, McCaffrey really hasn't recruited well at all. He's got, you know, the Murray twins, obviously, but they were two stars. Turned out big. Garza. Mm-hmm. But J.P. Estrella, four-star, I read an article where he wanted to come to Iowa, but the NIL money was too much for him not to go to Tennessee. And then I hear about this collective that says – all athletes get paid the same amount, no matter what sport you're playing. You guys know anything about that? I mean, that's going to be a big thing if we're not even close. If not really in the game.
I don't know. I would hope that Iowa would be making a priority of trying to get this NIL stuff going, because I think it's going to have all the difference in the world in getting the really top notch recruits. Supposedly. The stories were that one reason we got Caden Proctor to come to Iowa was because we were telling him that, hey, you can make a ton of money on NIL if you come to Iowa, which it kind of surprised me, because I didn't think Iowa would be trying to, whether it's true or not, that they would be trying to make that pitch. I don't know if that's what persuaded him, or if it was just because of his buddy Nwankwo for coming here and that's why he came. But we were trying to use NIL as a lure with Proctor. At least that was the story, I think. Now, I don't, you know, which, you know, if Kirk Ferentz can do that, or our football recruiting teams can do that, then Fran really needs to get with it. And if we're not, you know, Big Ten school, there's no reason why Iowa shouldn't be able to compete and try to foster some NIL stuff for to get
yeah,
some recruits in.
They made a big deal out of that collective. If that's what it's going to be, then we got major problems.
I still think at the next NCAA meetings there's some stuff that's going to have to come down. I mean, I got to believe that something is going to happen with, vis-a-vis NIL mixed with transfer portal. I mean, I think they're going to have to figure out a way to keep, because there's tampering going on. And, people say, well, it's always been going on. Yeah, but not really, because there really wasn't much to offer. I mean, yeah, there was light tampering maybe, but for the most part, I don't think so. It wasn't as easy, but now it's like it's open season. I just don't see them, I don't see it lasting at this level. I just don't. Something's going to have to give. I mean, either A, some kind of sit-out period, or B, some kind of limitation on NIL, something. I mean, it's just I don't see any other way for it to become a matter of having. But
I think equally as important as the NIL is I think we need to get rid of this the transfer portal crap where we need to go back to where you have to sit out a year. I think that's really causing a lot of havoc and unfairly.
Yeah.
And so fine, we have the NIL, but hey, if you're going to start, you shouldn't just be, COVID kind of changed things a little bit. We're past that now. We need to go back to the old transfer rule. Do I think it's going to happen? No, because I think there's a vested interest in wanting to keep it this way. But I think it's a shame, and I think I don't think players should just be able on a whim to just shift over and then be able to play right away. I think we need to go. But I think that's a big problem. I think we need to get back to the old transfer rules. But do I think it's going to happen? No, I don't.
I think it's going to have to be some kind of a blend. Like, if you want immediate eligibility, then you're not eligible for NIL for your first year. Something like that, I think might be a way to do it.
Yeah, there should, and your point is there should be some penalty if you're going to transfer.
Yeah. I mean, something that might
give you a little bit of pause before you. Right now there's no disincentive. It's a bidding thing.
Yep, exactly.
Or I don't like something, I'm out, that kind of thing. Shouldn't be quite that easy, I think.
I agree. So, okay, any final thoughts? Indy, any final thoughts before the game this weekend?
No, it's going to be an interesting game. I wish I had some crystal ball, but, Hank, we might lose by 60. We might be a 27-10 game, like Hawkeye Mike says. We might win the damn thing. You just never know with our defense. And,
right.
The offense, maybe they take that next step. They started to show improvement last week, last couple weeks with Petras. So who knows, Maybe they're pumped up. They're going in. There's no chance. 27-point, that's a slap in the face. But we'll see. It depends how they respond, I guess.
Yeah, Mike, any final thoughts?
Well, it's an early game. We're on here at 10 o'clock Colorado time. I think that's good, actually. Glad we don't have to wait till the evening or something or even late afternoon to see the game. So whether it's good or bad, it gets over quick. So, I always kind of got to.
You're making it sound like suicide, Mike.
You can get on with your day, right? but I think that Iowa's got nothing to lose, and that's always good, kind of a game situation.
Yep.
Ohio State could well be looking past them a little bit, despite Ryan Day's remembrance of 2017. No one else on that team, no one else on the field for Ohio State's going to remember or have any memory of that. It could easily be the blowout that I think you think it's going to be, Hank. I don't discount. I mean, it could be 60-0. I mean, who knows, right? Sometimes I wonder if that's what happens in the long run. Might that be good because it'll really be another jolt to what's going on at Iowa football right now. But I really think it's going to be like a Yeah, throughout 27-10, but I mean, I think you see what I'm saying. Is it, could it be like
sure.
a 24-3 game or 24-7 or 31-13 or, you know, something like that? I think that I'm leaning more towards that happening than 60-0 or an Iowa upset, but you never know. That's why they play the game. See what happens.
Yep. Fair enough. Okay. Well, that'll come up next week. We'll be back to reminisce about the game, or maybe who knows.
Lament it. Yeah.
Yeah. Two weeks from now, we're going to do our pre-election talk. To predict, Mike, you look at your area. I'll look at my area to see who, who's, which incumbents are in danger, which races are shocking, et cetera.
Yeah,
et cetera,
it's going to be very interesting. I'm optimistic for a fun night on election night. Get the popcorn out that night and enjoy.
Well, then of course, the week after that,
it's the best sporting event in town. An election where Republicans are kicking ass. Let's hope that's what happens.
We'll talk about the results of that and whether. I see the cheating. I mean, when I hear that 2.3 million ballots have been returned mail-wise, that just frightens me. You know, I mean.
What states are you talking? I think Florida was one of the states, and I think from what I saw a statistic on that was that compared to 2018 and 2020, the Republican, which usually the Democrats are in the early type mail-in voting, have an advantage, they have less of an advantage, which I don't know if that's the case, then that's another good sign of a big night on November 8th for the Republicans.
Yep. Peter, we'll, of course, talk by text or whatever this weekend during the game, and then next week we'll be back to either lament or reminisce and then start talking some more basketball and some election stuff. Great having you on. Thanks. We'll talk later.
Thanks.
All right. Take care, guys.
Okay. There you have it from Hawkeye Mike and Indy Hawk. Let's just say I don't have the most I'm really just not feeling too much. We can always be surprised. And, maybe, as Mike says, maybe that's the shakeup that we need if it's a blowout. So, in the meantime, keep watching the election stuff. Keep watching Second Amendment stuff. I didn't get to it today because I had stuff. But in some Second Amendment, quote unquote, the fear that from the left that the Supreme Court is basically going to take Second Amendment cases off the table. They're basically going to say that, look, the Second Amendment is what it is, and we're not going to hear any more of these cases. So we'll see. We shall see. In the meantime, folks, have a great week. Have a great weekend, of course, and have a great next week. And we will be back next Wednesday. Don't forget, Vito and Al on Monday, Eric on Tuesday, Paul Sutliff on Thursdays, Andrew on Fridays, Minister Osama Dakduk and the beautiful Christie on Saturdays, and then Eric back on Sundays. That's it for this week from Hank Jones Power Sports. Have a great week, folks. We will see you next week. Yeah, let's send off. What are we going to send it off with? We'll send it off with something good. Here, we'll send it off with a little Gino Vannelli.
My, what a marvelous time. Wear your pants and leather shoes. You gotta win and never lose. Oh, and why, oh, why? Oh, Jack, I cry. If it happens to you today. Why, such a glorious guy? Easy friends or easy foes? Ooh, you never know. Oh, and my, oh, my. Oh, Jack, you'll die. Stay.
Good night, folks.
Bye-bye.